Excited to welcome University of Tulsa head coach Eric Conkle to the basketball podcast. Across 11 seasons as a Division I head coach, Conkle owns a career record of 217 and 143. During the 2025-26 season, he guided Tulsa to a breakout 30-8 overall record and 13-5 mark in American Conference play, finishing tied for second in the league and advancing to the conference semifinals for the first time in more than a decade. The 30 victories ranked as the second most in program history. And Tulsa reached the NCAA championship game as runner-up, capping one of the nation's most impressive turnarounds. Prior to returning to Tulsa, Conkle spent seven highly successful seasons as head coach at Louisiana Tech, where he ranks third all-time on the program's all-time win list. He led the Bulldogs to six 20-win seasons, finished among the top three in Conference USA standings five times, and captured the 2020-21 Conference USA West Division title. That same year, Louisiana Tech advanced to the T Final Four and finished third, earning Conkle Conference USA Coach of the Year honors. Conkle has served as an assistant coach at Tulsa as a student assistant, Tennessee as a graduate assistant, and George Mason and Miami. Hey, Coach, brief interruption from your podcast to hear from one of our top supporters, Hoopsalytics. Is your starting lineup not performing to your expectations? What if your star player is injured? Who should you play together instead? You can answer questions like this using the powerful Hoopsalytic basketball platform to reveal your most productive players and lineups. Just ask the AI assistant, and based on extensive player and lineup stats and analytics, you'll get accurate, data-driven answers instantly. You can literally ask anything about teams and players and then start making even better strategic decisions. Hoopsalytics also provides top-tier video link stats with a 12-hour turnaround time, as well as handy visualizations, interactive shot charts, coaching stats, easy-to-create film sessions, and lots more. And unlike the alternatives, you get unlimited video storage with no hidden fees. Best of all, Hoopsalytics is more affordable. Now in year seven, Hoopsalytics is a true game changer for thousands of basketball coaches. Visit hoopsalytics.com/ball. That's hoopsalytics.com/ball and start using advanced stats and AI to win more games today. Eric, welcome to the basketball podcast.
Chris, thanks so much for having me. Really appreciate this opportunity to be with you and all the stuff that you do.
Thank you so much. Fun. Man, last time I saw you, the NIT, those were such entertaining games, great offense being played, competitive games, and congratulations. What a season. 30 victories and
thanks. It was really a special group of guys. You start with that and their ability to come together quickly, some talented young men, and to be able to progress through the season, get into the postseason, which hasn't happened here in a while. And then to be able to get all the way to Indianapolis, which was just a terrific event, but had some really good games against some really good teams.
30 wins, obviously a lot went right. Talk to us maybe in general terms then, beyond the players, obviously coaching staff, et cetera. What clicked this year for you guys?
As I look back, Chris, and reflect, and we've had a little bit of time to do that. First of all, we've had great continuity on our staff. Duffy Conroy, Yaphet King, Desmond Heyman, Josh Wolf, Alan Massey, and then a new staff member, Dyshawn Hobson. But those guys have been with me a long time, even going back to Louisiana Tech. And I look during the 4 years that we've been here, so many seeds have been planted in those early days, knowing that wouldn't be able to be harvested till much later down the road. And that's from administration to fundraising to a number of things. But frankly, we were able to find a great group. We had a lot more support from the university and this rev share model to be able to find the right type of guys that really worked well together. I thought they complemented each other very well. And then we got better as the year went on.
Awesome. And you shared it with me, but a little bit of the philosophy, and that's attitude, commitment, and class. Talk to us about that.
I worked for Jim Larrañaga for 11 years, Chris, and this was a part of his philosophy. He talks about many years ago meeting Dick Bennett and talking about how you have to really put everything on one page, the big things. And that philosophy rang so true to me, and we brought it here during my time as a head coach. But number one, we start with attitude. We want guys that are energy givers, guys that know how to handle adversity. Second, we want guys that are totally and unconditionally committed to the program, but then also their own development. We want guys that are passionate about doing this. And this can't just be a job. This has got to be a life that we're all just so excited about waking up and doing every day. And then third, we want to do things in a first-class manner. It's hard enough to beat the other team. We don't want to beat ourselves with distractions, foolishness, things like that. It's really knowing that we represent so much bigger than ourselves.
Knowing a little bit about Jim and obviously knowing a little bit about you as well, I know a big foundation is teaching. And that's what stood out from getting to know Jim and a lot of the people from his staff over the years. And I know you're the same. So talk to us about the importance of not just coaching, but teaching.
I think we have the opportunity to use basketball as a real vehicle to help young men. And of course, the way that it happens has changed. But whether a player is with us for 1 year or 5 years, we want to take every opportunity we can to use what we've each been taught. Me from my time with Coach Larrañaga, from the coaches that I had the opportunity to play for, but to find a way to enhance and help them spring their life forward after their time with us. And that's not just basketball. Of course, that's a major focus, but in the ways that we do everything.
I knew there's many reasons we are connected, and one of them is obviously that you love to play a lot of basketball and practice. So talk to us about that and the philosophy and maybe some of the ways that you do that.
Yeah, I think it's the most fun, right? I think you think about other sports and how there's so much breakdown and they don't really get to play the game very often. I remember I played baseball also through high school, and we spent a ton of time on situational. We spent a lot of time in the batting cage, but it's rare that you really get to this play the game. And we try to play the game, and I just say it all the time. We want to play the game as much as we possibly can. 1-on-1, 2-on-2, 3-on-3. We played a lot of 4-on-4 this summer with some of the injuries we had. We like to play a lot of advantage basketball, put guys in random decision making. We work on different structures, but we want to play the game as much or as anybody as possible.
People that listen to the podcast know the philosophy and couldn't agree more. But I think the challenge that coaches still have is understanding how you coach and how you move your team along while they're playing. So talk to us about some of your strategies for coaching while they play, or whether you stop it or you don't stop it, et cetera, et cetera.
So first, we'll talk about some different types of, for example, drive reactions and some things that we want to emphasize because there are a number of different ways to connect your team through a philosophy. If you're 4-to-5 cutting or corner cutting in certain areas, we will talk about that. And then we'll do it in more of a system where, hey, this is, we'll do it static. Hey, whether it's 3-on-0, 4-on-0, this drive, then we'll add coaches. Then we'll add randomness where there's, say, for example, a coach behind a player with a ball, and he puts his hand on one side. The defense has to go and touch that hand. Now it creates a drive, and now there's a reaction. And so we'll do that. We'll do it in the half court. Then we'll add live play out of it. Advantage, then we'll do down, back, down. We call it three trip game, but we want to build the game up and we start that right away in the summertime.
So you will stop it to correct, but I'm guessing generally what you're trying to do there is you're trying to give them a chance to explore first before you stop them and correct. And then are you correcting in the moment or is that more video later in terms of the education process for your players?
Yeah, we try to correct later. If it's a core principle that's a non-negotiable, for example, we want to crash the glass really hard on our three-point shots and a guy doesn't do it, we may take the opportunity to correct it right away. But I think there is nuance in a lot of offense. I think we do want to color outside the lines from time to time, but give the guys an opportunity to make the play, let it continue, and then bring them back to that with a short teaching point.
Man, it's one of the hardest things to do, isn't it? In a game-based philosophy, is to not stop it when you know that possibly you have an answer. But of course, what we've all learned is our answer isn't always the best answer.
I think the best part, Chris, is when you've worked on some things for a little bit and it's the players that will help correct each other. Hey, you need a cut there. And that's when you know you've got some things going, where you're building a connection among your team is when they're starting to teach each other as well.
You referenced the three trips. Talk to us, maybe go in a little bit more detail. Again, coaches coming into the season soon here in the fall. When you do three trips, are you prescribing something to start with and then there's some freedom, or is there certain things that are prescribed throughout? How are we shaping learning within those three trips?
So we can use it for some things strategic. If, hey, we could start with an out of bounds under with a 10 seconds left. We could use it 20 seconds, take the ball on the side where you have a possession and then the game continues. And what we really tried to do last year was cancel the pauses of the game to where, hey, whether we got scored on or we got a stop, this game is being, there's a thrust back up the floor. And so we'll use those ongoing games to maybe try something where that first possession is a set. Again, out of bounds under, zone offense, side out, certain situation, but then the pauses are canceled in the three trips, and then we'll end down on the other end and let the other team do it.
I love that phrasing, pauses of the game. So, can you explain that a little bit deeper for some coaches to understand it?
So last year, Chris, we really wanted to figure out a way to be in attack mode more often. Now, we didn't play at a blazing speed, but we did average 85 points per game. It's the highest points per game of my coaching career, but it wasn't where we were shooting in the first 7 seconds all the time. But we really worked on entries, actions for the guys to read off each other, where I wasn't trying to, I call it puppeteer the game and call a set all the time. There may be moments of that later in the game, time and score, but we want to cancel the pauses of it and get our guys in attack mode more often. We get scored on, all four guys can take the ball out, get the ball up the floor, and these are things that we're looking to do. Same thing on the defensive end of us getting set and moving into the next play quickly.
It's fascinating stuff. And you referenced advantage games and talk to us. Advantage games seem simple, and I see a lot of coaches adopting them, and a lot of coaches always have done these. But one of the challenges of advantage games, which I'm sure you found out, is that sometimes the advantage becomes too big an advantage if you do it too often. So talk to us about manipulating advantages in different ways so that you shape, again, the optimal amount of challenge.
Yeah, so I think as a head coach, your eyes could be directed towards what you're emphasizing in the moment, whether it's offensive or defensive. But we try to put our team in as many situations to test both ends, whether it's how to kill a baseline drive, but then when you have an advantage on offense, how do you handle it? So you can have iron sharpening iron. And so we'll put our team in situations where, hey, there's different types of full court advantages. There's half court advantages. There's advantages out of a post play where there's two on the ball. There's advantages out of a pick and roll with two on the ball. We just want to put our guys in those decisions as much as possible. The advantages that I think become too great are when it's 5-on-3. You don't really see that all that often. But I think there's so many advantages. Good offense is to create long closeouts if you didn't get an open shot. If we have an open shot, take it. But if the defense has scrambled properly and has got you into a kind of a sped up situation, we got to be able to work on those because that's where you got to be able to take advantage.
You referenced putting them in as many decision-making situations as possible. Obviously, coaches can get a feel for that with your advantage games and your different types of small-sided games and 5-on-5. But one thing that you guys did, which is connected to decision-making, is that you set a conference record for made threes. Talk to us about, again, helping your players understand the decision to shoot a three, a good three, and clearly it led to great success.
Something that we felt could be a potential differentiator for us is we went all in on recruiting 3-point shooting. We found guys in the portal, in the junior college, and the high school ranks that we felt could be very good 3-point shooters. It's something that's a huge part of our development here. We spend a ton of time shooting, but within the game, it's something that I feel, and I got this from Coach Larrañaga, being able to empower guys and their confidence. We have some statistical measures, Chris, where they're challenges, they're different drills that just say, hey, I can make 3-point shots. And then it's something that I use as the head coach that if a very good green light shooter, we call them, is passing up on open threes, that can get you out of the game as well because we expect guys to take open shots. It could be early clock first side, it could be second pass on a reversal of the floor. And then there's different actions that we'll run for some of our best shooters. But we felt like for last year's team in particular, we wanted to get fouled and we wanted to shoot threes.
So you reference recruit, obviously good shooters. Maybe talk to us about that. Maybe what are some of the looking to identify a shooter? Because what I'm experiencing watching youth basketball on the boys and the girls side, especially the EYBL level, is it's really hard to identify a shooter from live play because they don't necessarily get great touches or consistent touches. And that seems to be one of the things in kind of identifying shooters.
So I think when you get into the weeds of evaluating shooting, yes, you can look clearly at what was their percentage last year, but that's pretty easy for everybody to evaluate. When you see a guy that shot 40% from three and made 100 of them last year, everybody's going to see that and say, that's pretty good. We had a player named Ade Popolo that was a very good shooter at the junior college level, and he was a very good shooter for us last year as well. It just was one of those guys that maybe a lot of people weren't evaluating. But then we've also looked at some guys who maybe didn't get a lot of volume, but shot a pretty good percentage. We'll also look at free throw shooting just as a way to understand, hey, are they a good shooter? Because I do think when guys make a good level of free throws, that's helpful to know. And then the other thing, when we really get into it, Chris, we'll take a deep look at what kind of selection do they have. Were they off the dribble? Were they heavily contested? Just what are the types of shots that they're taking at their previous school?
And what, give us some examples, maybe. Let's go back. Let's give us some examples. You mentioned green light shooting, Mike Nabor's term, I'm assuming somewhat. Is it the same drills? Are there different drills or different standards? And what is a good standard now for a Division One male men's basketball player?
So we've used for many years, and we have a number of drills. We have a lot of contests, a number of ways to keep raising the expectation and challenge of the guys. When you recruit competitive guys, they enjoy those types of measures. But many years ago, got this from John Beilein, is just the 5-minute threes drill. Just line them up, one rebounder, one shooter, and shoot as many as you can. And if you can get over 50 consistently, you've got the green light to shoot open threes. We've had a number of guys be over 60 repeatedly. We call them neon green light shooters. Like anyone that they think that they can get off clean, they should shoot it. And then in the 40s, you're yellow light, and 39 and below, you're a red light guy. I tell this story often. I remember when I was became an assistant at the University of Miami, we had a player named Kenny Kaji. He was 0 for 1 on his career from shooting three in college, in 2 years of college. He was 6'10". He told me he was a stretch four man, and he said he can shoot the three. So we had this test. He made 37, Chris, the very first time. And what was great about Kenny was rather than say, hey, this is irrelevant, I can make threes in games, he just said, let's do it again. And then he got to 50, and he made 75 threes over his next 2 years at the University of Miami. So I do think it's something that, yes, physically guys can work on, but sometimes 3-point shooting is really between the ears even more.
I couldn't agree more. And I'm thinking, even as you said that, there can be a one-time occurrence of somebody getting 50. So what is consistency? Is that every time getting 50, or is that a certain percentage of times getting 50?
So we will chart this and we'll put an Excel file together. We'll post it in the locker room and we'll rank it because I like guys knowing as you one more a pass, if I'm a yellow light and I got a chance to one more it to a green light, I should do it. But we say if you average 50 over your last five.
Okay.
So we'll post that. We'll post their highs, their lows. We'll show the consistency of some guys, but it's a fun thing to chase.
It's really fun. And I think we underestimate the value of being competitive as a shooter as well. That enjoyment of trying to reach a goal and the excitement of trying to reach a goal. We talk a lot about developing shooters, but talk to me about kind of refining shooters. Because to a certain extent, you're trying to identify good shooters already. And what's really hard in shooting is clearly going from 40% to 41 or 45 to 46%. And I think we don't talk about that enough. So talk to me about some of the things that lead to that improvement.
I think footwork, I think the balance in which people shoot with is so important. I think as guys advance, that's where the difference really becomes. I think you can be a, let's say, if you like to teach righty shooter left when you're stepping into it, there's only so many of those you can really get. And the better you become as a shooter, the more people are going to try to prevent those threes. And that's where the footwork, the balance going left, maybe popping into it, catching it off handoffs, like all those types of things. That's where I think guys can improve. We had a player last year, Miles Barnstable, incredible story, played Division III basketball for 2 years, went to St. Thomas, played for a great program and coach in Johnny Tower, and then came to us and set a school record for making 100 threes. And he did them off the run, of course, off the catch, off the dribble at times. But he was a guy that he lived in the gym, and we worked on a number of different ways for him to get his balance.
Is there a correlation between, say, making 50, making 60 in the 5-minute drill, and then being able to be a movement shooter? Or is there different tests to be able to define a movement shooter, different tests to be able to shoot an off the dribble shooter?
Yeah, that's a great one. We do have some movement tests and drills, but what we really look at is we look at the 5-minute threes drill, Chris, is almost like a benchmark. It's almost like this is your ability to earn the right. And then once you do that, we, in all live play, 4-on-4 or 5-on-5, we will chart the summer and we'll have corner threes above the break threes. We'll get into the weeds off the catch, off the dribble, but we really try to define for guys what they're best at by using all the data from the summer and the fall. And then we'll identify which guys might be run and shoot shooters, flare shooters, ripping off handoffs, like things like that, or which guys are, hey, they're best being really spotted and being spacers and playing off of dribble penetration.
I don't want to stick on shooting too long, but I love talking about shooting. It's so fascinating. And so do we have enough data now that like there is a correlation? And if so, what is the number? You shoot this percentage from the free throw line, and it's likely to translate to 3-point shooting?
So I wouldn't say we have an official data point. I would say when we look at shooting and we evaluate their shot profile of some guys have heavy off thumb, just different things that we'll look at it. But when we look at a guy being able to make free throws, we just assume that over time they can extend that range, that they're shooting it straight, they're shooting it well. And I always think that if a guy is at least over 75, but then you see these guys at 85% free throw shooters, I just assume that over time they can develop into a 3-point shooter.
I love it. And you mentioned earlier some of the non-negotiables. So maybe let's stick because we're talking about offense. What are some non-negotiables on offense in your program?
Well, we want to play faster this year. So we've talked about getting to space in 3 seconds and action in five. And so it's non-negotiable. Of course, there's nuance. If a team is picking up, if they're tagging up, if they're jamming the outlets, there is some nuance to that. But we want to get space fast down the floor. And it's something that we've talked more about this year. Last year, we had the best offensive rebounding percentage of my career. It wasn't something that I emphasized very much as a head coach, but we did it more last year. We want to lean into it even more. So we've been charting crash percentages. We want to get all four to the glass on threes. We want to really go after it. That's a non-negotiable. But then there's the real non-negotiable, Chris, is we want to play with an unselfishness. We want guys to know who they are. We also want them to know their teammates and that when it comes to assisted basketball, it's recognizing, hey, I've got a decent shot, but Chris over here has got an awesome shot. And it's a hard thing to stat. But there is an overall, through the collection of data, through guys we talk about, when a guy will pass up an open shot, that may be a time I stop practice and I'll ask somebody, hey, do you want Chris over here shooting that shot? And they'll say, yes. And so there's an overall feeling of what guys are supposed to do.
Yeah, the power of a question in those cases is really good, right? Players are much better at kind of understanding, in a way, even shot selection, because they know who should be shooting to a certain extent, and the question helps guide them to the answer. Talk to us about using video then. You referenced that in terms of teaching, connecting the stuff you're doing on the floor, using coaching interventions, obviously, and then the video to be able to support that or obviously teach the point in the first place. So, how are you using video to be able to teach specifically offense?
So we really use it in four ways. We'll use video to present to the entire team for the big picture ideas, the big picture reactions, and every once in a while to address something that we've just got to fix. But we'll do that to the entire team, and those could be some longer sessions. We'll also use it out on the floor. Maybe we're looking to introduce something and we have video to introduce that before we hit it, or maybe something that we are trying to adjust, but it's immediately before we dive into it on the floor. And so that could be a clip or two. We'll also do some things where we'll have some offensive or defensive or other types of video on a loop in the locker room. I find that it's a great way for guys to Sometimes they're with a teammate. It could be right after weights. Maybe they got some shots, and then it just creates conversations of guys. We'll have a caption. It'll just be a few of them, but it's on a loop. And then the fourth way is sending guys clips individually, and where it's on their phone, they can access it anytime and just create some type of conversation on top of the individual video sessions that we'll have.
Love that. Love hearing this.
Hey, coach, I'm excited to let you know that we just released a full 86-minute masterclass on how we develop youth players and teams in simple and easy to apply ways. These are the same methods that I used with local teams here in Los Angeles that have gone from getting beat by 30 to beating teams by 30. At Basketball Immersion, we coach kids for the long term, so they're still engaged, confident, and improving later in their basketball career. Not just winning games at 8, 9, and 10. When you join, you get access to a youth coaching masterclass that's transforming programs around the world, plus our full library of incredible ready-to-use resources and courses. This masterclass alone is worth the investment, and your players will thank you. Go to basketballimmersion.com/sales today to get started.
You've been a head coach for a very long time. You've stacked up 21 seasons. What are you doing today that you didn't maybe do in the past, but also that you didn't necessarily understand? Because coaching has certainly evolved, and so has our knowledge of coaching has evolved. So, what are some things maybe different from now versus the beginning of your career as a head coach?
The beginning of my career, I was ordering DVDs and listening to other people. Now it's your
Some
site.
people don't know what those are, even, coach.
That's right. The ability to access information is incredible. I remember early on being one of the first Synergy customers and doing video scouting that way and realizing just how often I could find ideas from other people. I'm a collection of the people I've been around in the research that I've made. So I'm constantly curious and trying to find other ways to do things. That coincides with just how different college basketball is now, Chris. My early years at Louisiana Tech, we had a number of guys who were in our program for 4 and 5 years. And so there was that continuity that was built in terminology. So I've really worked, we've had a lot of continuity on our staff. And so we've really tried to refine our language, our terms, the way we're teaching, the way we build up to a roster that's almost entirely brand new each year. And so that's been different.
Yeah, it's a fascinating time to be a coach, no doubt. And just because you brought it up again, the staff continuity, obviously, we can think of the strength of that. What are some of the challenges of maybe having a consistent staff over time? And what are some ways to overcome it? Because, again, you're not the only coach to have coaches with you for multiple years.
Yeah, I think naturally you could say that, hey, this is the way we've done it. Let's just continue doing it that way. I have a saying that let's make sure that we don't become dinosaurs in our field, and dinosaurs is how we're doing things. We've had enough changeover in some of our younger staff members, and I'm very intentional of going out and finding guys from other places and getting some new ideas. We also do an after-action report after every season to get feedback from every single guy and have honest communication about these are the things that we felt we did well, these are the things that we've got to get better at. And then also encourage everybody to talk to their network or other people and find out new ideas and think of ways that we can evolve how we scout, how we play offense, defense, the way we fundraise. I've spent a lot of time talking to European GMs about how they put a team together. There's constant ways for us to evolve and get better.
Oh, I love that last one. What were some of the things you learned from that experience of asking their general managers?
I think a number of things of it is how they contract their players. How do they, in the early NIL days, Chris, I know there was a lot of conversation about, hey, does everybody get the same? Who gets what? Like, how do you contract these things? And as this has evolved institutionally into a rev share model where the contracts are coming from the school, it's not a consistent thing across every school. It's not like it's a your contract is the same as mine, is the same as theirs. So we've looked at how does this get broken down? How are European teams doing it? They have some guys that stay, they have young guys that are in their club system, they have guys that they're pulling from other areas. Here's a good one. I asked this one GM of, does he consistently look for players from a higher division, a Euro Cup, to bring down, or is he looking for guys from a lower division to come up? Just different things like that.
That's a fascinating question for you and so many college coaches, isn't it? To be able to identify some of those players that aren't playing as big a role or maybe are playing too big a role and different things like that, and then how it translates to your level. I love that. I love that thinking that goes with it. And you mentioned the roster turnover. Something that's been asked of me multiple times in different ways this summer is, what are different coaches doing to be able to bring players together? And you've mentioned it to me that you love building relationships and you spend a lot of time on that. But particularly in this mindset where these players don't necessarily have a common history together. And what are some different ways that you can connect them to this common goal and this purpose moving forward?
So I think there's a number of things from a team building standpoint where there's communication. I live 2 miles from campus. We'll have the team over to the house and have a pool party, just have fellowship, have community. We'll do a number of exercises where the guys are basically forced to speak in front of the team and tell them a little bit about themselves. It's the five H's model of your history, your heartbreak, your hopes, and so forth. But very honestly, Chris, what I have found, and I think about my own life as a not so great player, but how much I got to know people at the Final Four playing pickup games. And when the pickup game is over and you're sitting on the sideline and you're talking about the game and you're just getting to know each other, we play a lot in the summer, not just to work on the game, but I think it's a way to fast track your relationships with your teammates, where you get to learn how a guy plays, learn how a guy is wired. But those conversations in the locker room where you talk about some of the great plays and who dunked on who and who did this and who did that, I think playing the game is such an accelerator for community.
I love that thinking, and particularly around playing pickup in the summer. There's no better way to be able to develop these understandings of conflict resolution, competitiveness, who my teammates are, what they're about, all those different things. And that's really cool to be able to hear. With that, then, the relationship piece, you mentioned this. Obviously, coaches talk about it a little bit. How do you have a hard conversation with a player?
So I'm part of that team building. I regularly have individual meetings with our players. I have a note-taking system that I like to put together so I can ask them questions and put it on paper. There's a part of the recruiting process where we're very upfront. Well, we'll guarantee and promise three things: opportunity, the very best from our coaching staff, and then third, absolutely promise and guarantee that it's going to be hard. There's going to be adversity. And I make sure to say those things in the recruiting process and couple it with the demanded commitment that we expect from everybody, the attitude, of course, how we're going to do things in a first-class manner, to try to put that way out up in the front, in the open. And then when guys come here, essentially, we'll talk about goals. We'll talk about their dreams. We'll talk about expectations. We'll talk about reality. And then I'll ask for permission to basically say, Chris, I know these are your goals. I share these goals with you. Do I have your permission to do everything I know possible in anything that I think can help you attack these goals? And naturally, guys say yes. And I'll remind them of that if they have any issue attacking things that we want them to.
I love that. Of course, you reference it, and every coach is in this situation to a certain extent with the roster turnover. And I know you have a lot more time than, say, a high school coach, but put on your high school coaching hat. What are you starting with a new team? Because with college, it's hard to tell when your start date is anymore. And obviously, it's variable across programs. But what are the first things that you're doing on the court with your team?
So I actually spent 2 years at the high school level as an assistant. I worked for Ken Novak Jr. at Hopkins High School. He this past season became the all-time wins leader in the state of Minnesota's history, and then just retired. So I got an early look on this, and I remember, and I would think you normally start with first things first. What are the things that are most important to you, and how you're going to do that? Some will be how we're going to pass. Bo Ryan, who I played for 2 years, we started with a partner passing drill on the very first drill on October 15th. We've done it every year I've been as a head coach. We're going to pass the ball to one another, and we're going to do it with two hands. We're going to catch it with two hands. We're going to have proper feet. So I think that first practice and those first things you're doing, what are the most fundamental things that you're going to hang your hat on? Could be passing and catching, could be closing people out. It could be that we're going to play on 2 feet. It could be that we're going to rebound the basketball. Those are some of the things that we work on early in our practices.
It all comes together eventually, and that's the idea of this in terms of this process. So how are you evaluating day-to-day practice and then ensuring that obviously it's transferring what you're teaching to what you're going to do obviously in games? What are some things that you do to be able to evaluate whether it's working?
Yeah, so first, like we talk about the three things we can control always, Chris: our attitude, our effort, our body language. We've talked about attitude. Effort is we want to make aggressive mistakes when we make them. And so we want a pace about us. We want to be playing with an intentionality of effort. And then the things that are most important to us, first on the offensive end, is we want to be able to connect with the basketball. We want to connect with our shot selection. We want to connect with our passing to one another. That doesn't mean that we're passive or trying to be too careful. Turnovers are an okay thing if you're trying to make a play and you're making something that your intention is in the right place. But when we look at things, if it's working or not, it doesn't mean that it's a pretty practice. I like seeing that guys are trying things that we're wanting them to do, and is it connecting more than it did a week ago? Meaning drive reactions, meaning the next pass, seeing the floor, seeing the advantage. We track paint touches all the time. Are we getting there on the defensive end? Are we keeping them out of there? That's the seesaw battle of both. But there's certain things that we like looking at, but are we going really hard? Are we aggressive? And are we connecting as a group?
What, if anything, did the empty run reveal about your team that maybe the regular season didn't reveal as much?
That's a great question. I think the first thing I think about, Chris, is we had a very unique starting five. Our starting five was fifth in the country in plus minus, and nobody missed any games until David Green, our first team all conference player, missed the second half of our semifinal game in the conference tournament. He then missed the first two games of the. And that revealed just the depth of our team. Ramadeen Dean came off the bench and gave us a big lift. Our team rallied around the whole thing. We hadn't experienced that part of adversity that season, but I was so happy to see how our team responded to be able to win two really tough games without our first team all conference player.
Give us some perspective. So, how many new players do you have now coming in off that NIT?
So we have 10 new players. We have five returners. Three of those are scholarship players, and two of them were regular rotational guys. We had three seniors last year. We had six players that moved on to other opportunities. And I look at this thing very much like we talked about earlier, is I want guys that are be able to elevate and advance. If that's after 1 year or 5 years, whatever it might be, but I'm very grateful for all those guys.
We've got to embrace that, obviously, in this era, no question. And is there an advantage to not being able to rest on your laurels because a lot of players weren't there to a certain extent?
I think that's the way we're all wired anyway. The benefit of the run, Chris, here at the University of Tulsa, first of all, I got my start here as a GA many years ago. I was here for one season, and that was with Buzz Peterson right after Bill Self's tenure here. And Tulsa's got some rich tradition, and it's been dormant. It's not been consistent. So we're fighting for consistency, but there is a buzz, there's an electricity about Tulsa basketball in our city again that is really important. And it helped attract some good players that are excited about what's happening here and want to help us take that next step because we've still got a long way to go. But without a question, like you can't really, if you have 10 back and say seven of your top eight back, your thinking might be a little bit differently of making sure that complacency doesn't sink in. But we've got a brand new team. Every team is different unto itself, but this team is very different than last year's team.
I know you're really thoughtful in your approach, and it shines through in this podcast so far. So I can ask you this question: what do you think coaches are complicating nowadays. Because you referenced this earlier, and I know this is a real challenge for you and me and every coach coaching, that we almost have too much information, right? So we're potentially complicating some things. And that's what keeps coming back to me is talking to people like you and hearing you talk, simple as sophisticated, as Matt Driscoll said. So talk to us about some of the things that maybe you think we complicate sometimes as coaches.
I think offense, there's almost an infinite number of things that you can do. And there's a large number of things defensively you can do too, but it just pales in comparison because, and then there's so many different ways to be good. In so many different ways that people have been good, I should say. But I think that there's figuring out what it is that you really believe at your school and the way that you recruit and the way that you can win. And then figure almost reverse engineer that to, hey, what ways are most applicable to that? For example, we've decided we don't want to be a jack of all trades and a master of none. We went all in on 3-point shooting. We felt like that for that team last year, and we're going to try to continue that. But we feel like 3-point shooting attracts more 3-point shooting. And so you can have a cycle in your recruiting efforts because we're still not drafting players in college as of today, Chris. Guys have to choose to come here, and we want to have something stylistically that we can attach to. Then how do we do that? Each team is a little bit different, but you have provided so much information. I listen to all of them, and then you pull some things that maybe enhances some of the things you already believe. And then there's some real decisions sometimes, you know what? This might replace some of the things that I have been doing, but you just can't do everything. And that's a real challenge as a head coach.
Great answer. No doubt. The other thing is looking obviously at some of your success, you've certainly developed players into the NBA, G League, Summer League, etc. So player development, you already referenced, is a big part of it. Talk to us a little bit, like what is a metric? What are some of the metrics that really matter that tell you that these players are progressing? Because that seems to be, again, a question that I get often is how do you determine if a player is actually improving?
I think the first thing is that our staff, and again, I want to give great credit to our assistants, is in the evaluation of potential. And years ago, we used to look at young birthdays, especially guys that were developing later, and then figure out where they could become. That was more on a 3 and 4 year model. Now we still try to figure out, okay, where is some things that we might feel can be developed? I think the first thing is we measure strength and conditioning all the time. Like we really spend a lot of time in the weight room in the summer and we measure everything. And we, even as the head coach, I'll get reports. I'll meet with my strength coach and my athletic trainer early in each week and we'll talk about where everybody's at. And then I'll hit guys with nuggets and praise them. Hey, I saw you got up 5 pounds. Hey, we really try to maximize bodies here at Tulsa. And then shooting drills, other different competition things. I think letting guys know that you see them, you see the work that they're putting in, and that how that makes them feel. Again, between the ears and in the chest, I think you can really reach guys and help them feel confident, help them feel empowered. But then that ultimately, then when it's statted out on the court, we stat everything. We stat winning percentage in the summertime. We stat assist to turnover ratio, we stat rebounding, we stat everything. And then it's just being able to emphasize to guys like, hey, this is what you're doing really well. This is what you need to do better at. Really good players love that type of feedback, I believe.
It's amazing the amount of things that are statted nowadays. And, you know, part of that can make a player uncomfortable. And obviously, that's a big part of this. What I love that you said there is that it's not just you go from good to great, it's like all the steps in between from good to great that need to be recognized. So, talk to us. You mentioned seeing these things and noticing these things. Talk to us about some of the ways that you acknowledge or notice these things. Because the more I'm around people like you, I think this is really the art and the science blended together in coaching.
So the first thing we talk about being elite or being truly great is about being consistently really good. So we want to be efficient consistently. And it starts with that effort that we talk about. Come into the building with as an energy giver and give us everything you've got. And whether you're not feeling great or maybe you're battling through some type of minor injury, but whatever you got, we want all of it. And let's just keep pursuing up that mountain. But as a head coach, I feel like There's certain things that I want to be able to talk to the guys about that, not to say that they're impressed, but maybe surprised that I even know, or I'll take the time to say. And it could be their birthday, a parent's birthday. It could be something they're doing in the weight room, something that they've, a goal that we've set for them that they're achieving. It could be something academic. It could be something that's just different that connects with them as people. Because we talk about as we build trust and you build understanding and you do it on a much quicker arc than ever before, you got to immerse yourself in with these guys and make them feel like you care. And it's authentic here. It's not just something that I want to check off and say I did it. No, I enjoy people. I enjoy the players. They'll hear me say often, Chris, that one of the reasons I love coaching so much is it's the closest thing to being in the locker room as a player again. And I just love the players and the team, and I want to make sure they know that.
That's awesome. And we got to do it because coaches love these non-negotiables. We talked about the offensive ones. So, what are the defensive ones? And then I have a follow-up question.
Yeah, so defensively, we're really trying to protect the middle of the floor more this year, especially below the foul lines. We're trying to be really physical on the ball. We've talked about the first step and owning the first step. But the real non-negotiables, the ones that, we could stop practice and really make a point is our sprint on the way back. Because we're asking guys now, because we shoot a lot of threes, sending four guys to the glass, and then we say, hey, don't hang around. That ball is collected. Say we're playing against each other and you've got the rebound. I'm not going to hang around. I'm not going to swipe and do false hustle. It's recognizing, okay, Chris has got the ball. I am sprinting back. And we do evaluate those steps. That's something that we'll show guys. That is the number one thing, non-negotiable. You must sprint when it's the ball has changed hands. And then we do talk about rebounding an awful lot. We chart checkouts, blockouts, pursuits, things like that. And then we do an overall grade of physicality, Chris, on how physical are we? When there's an opportunity to hit, it's like little jabs in boxing. You're not just trying to throw knockout punches, but how many jabs can you get? A jab on the dribbler, a jab on a box out, a jab on a cutter, a jab to just break rhythm. We want to jab as much as we can.
Coach, with that, then the non-negotiables on defense, what are some things maybe that, again, this has changed over the years. What are some things that have become more conceptual defensively that have become, say, less of a non-negotiable within your program?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's something we've talked about a lot recently because even if you're trying to say no middle or you're trying to force baseline, we've talked about the concept of if the shoulders are by the primary defender, how to scramble out of it. And we've gone through these, like for example, and we've done this too, where you're no corner help. But when the ball is by you and the ball is threatening the basket, what are some different ways to completely stop it and scramble, to veer switch, to. And so we've worked on some things through some of our advantage offensive games where the offense has been providing an advantage of some different ideas. And sometimes the players will give you answers. Sometimes they'll start scrambling and doing different things. They'll communicate through some. And then it all of a sudden becomes teaching points for, okay, if the ball has completely gotten by us, stop the basketball and just run to the next. And those are some of the concepts where guys are working through some feel on how to get the ball stopped.
Love that. That's fascinating how much we've evolved defensively. And that's such a great example. 6-21 seasons coming into Tulsa, a little bit of a slower build. Talk to us a little bit about mentally pushing through some of that slower build and then obviously building a program in a very different way at two different places in terms of the results at the end.
Yeah, came here to the University of Tulsa for a number of reasons. And certainly the one, I'll go back, of two boys, Chris. They're both high school basketball players now, but at the time, one was about to turn 13 and one was 10. And I remember sitting them down and saying, hey, this looks like this could be an opportunity for us as a family. I just want to talk to you about it. And my oldest son said to me, and you could see the wheels turning, and he goes, do you think you can win there? It
Good
wasn't about
question.
it. Yeah. And I said, we wouldn't make any move if it didn't think that we could win. I did know that the early stages would be challenging. Of course, during our tenure here, college basketball has gone through a serious evolution. And throughout the tough times of looking to build and make changes and grow, and as I mentioned at the very beginning, plant seeds that would take some time. As I tell our team all the time, to control what we can control, I had to do the same thing. My attitude each day, my effort, my body language, because I am the leader and I need to be able to project confidence in the plan and to keep working that plan each day, even on the days that were dark and it's hard. We won 5 games our very first year. And to be able to go out and fundraise and project a plan, that takes a lot. And I'm grateful for my staff for sticking with the whole process too. The majority of our staff's been here throughout, but this is all about attitude, and it's all about keep chipping away, keep pounding that rock that you hear talked about, because we were able to put a crack in that rock last year, and we want to keep breaking it down.
It's probably not talked about enough. Clearly, I have you on the podcast to a certain extent because you had an incredible year, and that seems to be the way it goes for the podcast to a certain extent. But recently, I've tried to have some coaches on who are in the middle of building or the new approach of trying to figure things out with the portal and all the different stuff. And Erica Hughes comes to mind at Loyola Marymount that had as bad a few years as you could imagine when she started there, but she got support from her university, which is obviously the key part of this because there's a lot of impatience at different schools. And I'm imagining for you, like you didn't have that bad a start, but you had support and you had people that ultimately believed in what you were doing, whether it's your family or your coaches or people on the periphery. But no matter what, it's hard, isn't it? It's hard because your expectations are different.
Yeah, no question. My expectations are higher than anybody's. And but you go into each day trying to figure out, where can I affect change? What are battles that we can find some success on? But then also, what things can I plant today that hopefully I'll have enough time to harvest later? And a big part of that was fundraising. And so being out in the community, like I said, I live 2 miles from campus. I have kids in high school, try to be very visible and meet a lot of people that are passionate about Tulsa, and not just the University of Tulsa, but Tulsa in general, and be able to find different ways to bring them into the program, show them how they can impact our program. And then, very honestly, once our model went away from more collectives and into a more rev sharing, it was, I give a lot of credit to our administration for saying, hey, let's go forward a little bit more here and see what we can do. And I'm very happy we were able to take a nice breakthrough and show that it was a good investment in men's basketball.
And of course, you're used to sustaining success at Louisiana Tech over time. So now you're in that enviable position now of sustaining success. So what are some of the lessons that you learned from the past that can help you this year continue this?
So much of it is the people that you bring into your program. It starts with staff, and because I think a great staff and great people will go out and attract great players and great people. And we want those types of people that we've talked about, guys that got some energy about them, guys that love basketball, and then guys that we can trust to make good decisions off the floor too. But we work really hard at that evaluation process. It's much different than it was 3, 4, 5 years ago, but we try to find guys that will come into this program that fit how we do things, fit our campus, fit our community, because I think that's the most important lesson. As programs look to elevate more, not to all of a sudden say, hey, I got a chance to get an even more talented player, but then make concessions on some of the other stuff that has been so important to you on your climb up.
You've done it. You've done it. You've had incredible success at two different places, and you've had incredible success as an assistant coach. And now we can't wait, all of us that listen to this podcast, to see you guys play again this year, coach. Thanks for sharing the game with us.
Thank you, Chris, for sharing the game with so many of us that have benefited from it. I'll share this story. I'll never forget the first time, I think it was the first time I listened to your podcast was during COVID. And that was a savior for just the information and that time, and have been a regular listener ever since. Thank you so much for all that you do.
Thank you. And you reference listen to them all. Where do you listen? When do you listen? I'm just curious.
So by far, the greatest amount of listening I do is when I'm in the car. When I'm on drives, again, my sons have played a lot of youth basketball in either in Kansas City or Dallas. They're 4-hour drives. So I can knock a bunch of them out and just listen
Do
and be
they
able to.
listen or do they have their own headphones on?
It depends. Sometimes they'll listen, but a lot of times they're sleeping or they got their headphones in.
I love it. I just love hearing this. And it's so fun to be able to connect with people like you. And again, just outstanding. And make sure they listen to this one, and as it will everyone else as well, Coach. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.